tip today in association with Slattery's of Pecan, your main Peugeot dealer for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.
Good morning, welcome along to Tip Today, 1800-938-007. That's our free phone number. Doc Martin is looking after the programme today, and as ever, he'd be glad to hear from you. Coming up on this morning's show, what's happening in farming with the Irish Farmers Journal, an update on the Bursacane boil water notice. We speak about the passing of Jim Steinman, the man who wrote all of the songs for Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell album. And Minister for Further and Higher Education, Research, Innovation and Science, Simon Harris, will be with us live after 10 o'clock this morning. So all of that and much, much more on the way. First of all, though, let's have a look at what's making headlines today. To the Irish Independent, first of all, ministers push for foreign holidays by the end of the summer. International travel, including foreign holidays, could be on the cards later this summer. Ministers have signalled, and we'll be chatting to Simon Harris about that, among other things indeed. Also on the front of the Indo today, farming families own nearly 5 billion worth of shares in the biggest Irish publicly listed companies, making them a linchpin of the market alongside US funds. That's according to research by the Irish Independent. Let's have a look at what's making headlines in the Irish Times today. The J&J vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the government expecting to begin using the J&J COVID-19 vaccine as early as next week in what would be a significant boost to the under-fire inoculation program. Minneapolis Police Department faces investigation. The U.S. Justice Department has announced an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department a day after former officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murdering African-American George Floyd in the city last May. And also, schools to be given choice of gender-neutral toilets. Schools are being allowed to choose whether their toilet facilities will be gender-neutral under new construction and refurbishment guidelines from the Department of Education. The front of the Irish Examiner today, return to sun holidays likely by August. Again, that story. Return to foreign sun holidays likely before the end of the summer after the government said good news is on the horizon. Expert urges new search for human remains. A forensic archaeologist who has helped recover the remains of the disappeared in the north of Ireland has recommended a new search for human remains on the grounds of the former mother and baby home in Cork. And also on the front of the Examiner today, terrorism accused Smith fights exclusion from the UK. An Irish woman charged with membership of ISIS is fighting her exclusion from the UK. So that's just a little taste of what's making headlines in some of our newspapers today. 1800 938 007. Now, it's been reported today that schools are being allowed to choose whether their toilet facilities will be gender neutral under new construction and refurbishment guidelines from the Department of Education. And what we want to know from you today is, do you think this is appropriate? And do you think it's appropriate in the schools that there should be sharing of the toilet facilities? Talk to us about that. You can text and WhatsApp 083 311 3311. You can email tiptoday@tipfm.com. Now, a special online event hosted by Republic of Shame author Caelan Hogan opens up a conversation and a bringing together of intergenerational survivors of religious-run institutions who will share readings, poetry and their own experience. It's happening online this evening at 8 p.m. and I'm really glad to be joined online now by Caelan Hogan herself. Good morning to you, Caelan.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
And thank you for coming on with us today. One of the things that struck me reading about you and reading about your book, Republic of Shame, is that it's not as far in the past as we might imagine, Caelan.
It's not at all. When I started reporting about it, I admit that I didn't realize that myself. And Seanross Abbey, which, you know, obviously is in Roscrea, closed in 1969. So it was one of the earlier ones to close. But the mother and baby home institutions continued to operate and well into the 90s. Vesper, which was operated by the same religious order, didn't close till 1998. I think the last woman admitted actually was in or left in 1999. And then there was an institution that I discovered while writing the book in Donegal that operated until 2006. And that really shocked me. I mean, I was born in 1988, a year after the legal status of illegitimacy was finally abolished the year before. And this, this institution was operating well until my teens. So it's very, very recent.
And also very close to where you live yourself, you discovered that there were, these institutions were there that you just didn't know about.
Yeah, there was a place that I used to walk by every day, right near my house. And I found out while writing the book that it was an institution where children were sent for adoption. So it was run by St. Patrick's Guild, the Sisters of Charity. And actually, this guild sort of referred women all over the country to different institutions and arranged the adoption of their children, including many illegal adoptions as well that we've discovered. And actually, I remember going to Ennis to look through the diocesan archives for Seanross. Actually, they were the local diocese responsible, and St. Patrick's Guild would have sent back reports, so lists of women from the parish who they would have come into contact with and sort of report back to the local bishop of that parish, sending lists of names and where each woman had been sent to and what had happened. So, everyone, the Catholic hierarchy were well aware of sort of, each individual woman and what was happening and which institution she'd be sent to. And in those documents, I actually found letters between the local bishop at the time and a local health authority about what to do with so-called unmarried mothers, asking the bishop for advice. And he decided to break down women into three classes of offender, word he used. And there were women who, could be sent to institutions like Seanross and then maybe married or gotten a job. And then women who, maybe were vulnerable in a unique way. And then the third was women of a wild and vicious nature, to quote, who needed to be sent to the institutions run by the Good Shepherds, essentially for life. So those were the mouths and laundry.
It's incredible. You mentioned offenders there, and the language is something that struck me about these women as well. I mean, they were referred to as well, I think, as penitents, were they?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I remember talking, because in the book, I talk about my conversations with religious sisters as well. I really tried to speak with some of the nuns as well who had worked in these institutions. And I remember one who actually did, it was a novice who worked in the Magdalene Laundry for some time, and she remembers saying that was wrong. We called them penitents. There was an idea, and I think there's this narrative, and that came out in the recent final report, of course, that these places were in some way refuges or providing a service. And yet when you see the documents of church and state, it's there in black and white, the way that these women were considered. And it wasn't that it was for their own good or protection. It was to do penance or treated as almost as criminals for being pregnant.
And is it true, Caelan, that some of these institutions, they advertised their services in sort of, like using pamphlets and the like?
They did, yeah. St. Patrick's Guild would have pamphlets looking for funding, really. And so I remember there was a story of one woman that they used in the very early years, I think it was the 1930s, when Seanross would have would have opened. And using her story as an example, and it was strange because that woman admitted that, you know, no one would ever understand the loss of her child. And even though she had sort of lied to her family and pretended she was sick and got off to this institution, she was saying how, you know, it was just this sort of indescribable pain being separated from her child. And yet St. Patrick's Guild was using that to sort of recommend it, its services. So they were well aware, I think, the effect it was having on women. But of course, that continued for decades.
I think your book was finished before the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes report was released. But in the discussion about that, well, there was huge controversy and discussion about it. But one of the things that emerged was an almost blaming of the families and saying that, you know, they were complicit in this as well. Your thoughts on that would be what, Caelan?
I think it displaces a lot of blame from the authorities involved at the time. You know, it's a reality. There's many examples in the book of women who were sent away by their families. And you know, it was a huge secret and no one would talk about it. And it was never talked about it again. And that was very painful for women. But, you know, there were also families that were told by priests, by doctors, by social workers that this would be the best thing. You know, for their daughter, for their child. And then there were many, many families that never knew. You know, there's very little talk, I think, of the responsibility of social workers who are often paid by the state, and priests and members of the church and religious agencies as well, crisis pregnancy agencies like CURA that was set up by bishops. Mm. And that would have sent women to these institutions, and they never would have told their families or the fathers of their children if they were still in contact with them. So, you know, there was a lot of blame displaced on families and fathers and we as a society. And yet, you know, again, when you look at the records, and this is why I think there was this huge movement against the sealing of records late last year. Mm. Because they show in black and white, you know, the responsibility, how authorities set the system up, were very, you know, sort of oversaw it, and you know, were instrumental in sort of controlling how women were categorized, for how long they were sent to these institutions, etc. So I think it does. I think it's about liability and accountability.
And in terms of some of the women who would have spoken to you, is there still an element of stigma, still an element of shame?
There is. Well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, there's women who have never spoken about it. I've met women who haven't never even told their children or you know, their partners. There was one man I spoke to who actually I met in the Basilica in Knock. He's a volunteer there, a very, you know, a man of faith. But he was born in Tuam, and, you know, he's kept that a secret because of the shame of being so-called illegitimate or being sent to an institution and having a baby out of wedlock. So there's many people, I think, around the country that are holding the weight of that secret, and not because they should be holding any shame, but because of the shame that was imposed on them through the system, you know, through policy and legislation as well, which upheld that stigma of illegitimacy. And I think the idea of opening up these conversations and having events like tonight at The Source, luckily online, I would have loved to be coming down to do it in person. But, you know, we have survivors speaking, five different survivors speaking tonight about their own experience.
And one is Colleen Anderson, who was born in Sean Ross, and she was one of hundreds, I know, you know, sent from that institution to America for adoption. But again, to refer back to the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes, there was almost a denial of that. There certainly, they said there was no evidence to say that went ahead.
I mean, the report confirms that there were, you know, hundreds of children sent to the US for adoption. And I've, you know, sat down with Colleen and looked through her records, and what she really, you know, wants to find out is when she was actually put on a plane and sent away from this country to the US. And we've applied to the Department of Foreign Affairs for her records, and they hold affidavits from several people about the circumstances of her adoption. And she's been refused access, categorically just refused access to those records. So,
and do we know about money changing hands for this, for example?
It's very difficult, obviously. I didn't have access to those records. Mm. And it's hard to, I think, confirm. But
money,
of course,
did play a big part, didn't it?
It definitely did. And that's what I was saying. Survivors themselves have documents that show this.
Yes.
They have letters between their parents and the religious orders that clearly show that donations were requested or a set amount of money, especially for children adopted to the US. They would have been asked for a certain amount of money. I remember one man telling me, I think he once asked his father, and it was admitted to him it was over £100 or dollars, which at the time I think was a huge sum of money. And Teresa Collins, who'll be speaking tonight, says her grandparents had to pay £100 at the time for her mother and her to be taken out of the institution. So if you couldn't pay, the women who couldn't afford to pay or whose families didn't know would remain in the institution and be forced to work and, you know, earn their keep and look after the children separated from other women. But, there was a huge emphasis on donations and money, whether it was adoptions or whether it was simply a woman being able to leave the institution. And we still, again, the final report really didn't give us many answers on on what happened to that money or where it went. And there were claims that, more than 1,000 children died in Shawnross Abbey. And I think there were always claims of, lack of funding, being a part of the conditions. But then we remember that not only were the religious orders getting money from the state per head for women and children from local authorities, but they were also asking for donations and money from families. So I think that excuse of not enough funding for the conditions that led to so many deaths.
It doesn't stand up.
There
was a naive hope, I suppose, that the Commission's report would draw a line under this in some way. It certainly didn't do that. But going forward, I mean, how do you think we can deal with this and put it in our past, if you know what I mean, Caelan?
Well, I think there's Noelle Brown who's speaking tonight as well, and she was born in Bessborough, which was run by the same religious order. And I think she says it very well when she says that this is an equality issue. We've had, many changes in this country in recent years to sort of attain more equality. And the reality is that there's people who were born in these institutions and adopted who still don't have the right to their basic birth information. So to the name that they were born with, to their original birth cert. And so that's something I think that really needs to change. That's an ongoing inequality or discrimination that's continuing in our names today. And there's so many people still searching for their origins and for information. And there's so many barriers still in place, whether it's new things like GDPR being sort of misused to redact records and deny information. Survivors are really still searching for so many answers.
Yes.
And still facing silence.
And I know you've written on direct provision, for example, as well. I mean, will that be the institutions of our generation here now, do you think, when we look back?
I think there's many, many parallels, of course, with direct provision and emergency accommodation for homeless families. This ongoing institutionalization of vulnerable people, that we've seen the harms of that, and yet we do seem to be perpetuating it. Now, I know that there's a commitment to end the direct provision system, but it's essentially to turn it into, in some ways, a state-run operation. And, of course, the religious-run institutions were state-funded, and there were the county homes as well. So I think there needs to be a lot of vigilance around that.
You'd wonder whether or not we learn from history, but there you go. How can people view that wonderful event that's going to happen tonight, Caelan? How can they do so?
So it's a Zoom webinar. If you go to the Source website or their Facebook, they'll have a link, and you can just register, and it's a free event starting at 8 p.m. and just click on the link and join.
All right, looking forward to that. Caelan, thank you for your time this morning. Thank you and good morning to you.
Thanks.
That's the Republic of Shame author Caelan Hogan speaking to us there, and she's hosting that event tonight online from the Source Arts Centre in Thurles. 1800 938 007, the text and WhatsApp 083 311 3311. Now we're posing that question to you as to whether or not you would agree with the notion of gender neutral toilets in the schools. One of our listeners saying, I for one would not like to see my granddaughter using the same toilet as boys. Keep them separate. And it says here, I have my own personal reasons for this. So how do you feel about that? And again, will you share with us? 083 311 3311.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.